One of her hands instinctively rose to cover her, but he grabbed her wrist and held it against his own chest. He was straddling her, sitting upright, staring down at her, as if she were beautiful. He was looking at her the way men always looked at Hermione, except somehow there was more passion, more desire. She felt worshipped. "Lucy," he murmured, lightly caressing the side of her breast. I think... His lips parted, and he shook his head, slowly, as if he did not quite understand what was happening to him. "I have been waiting for this," he whispered, "for my entire life. I didn't even know. I didn't know." She took his hand and brought it to her mouth, kissing the palm. She understood. His breath quickened. And then he slid off her, his hands moving to the fastenings of his breeches. Her eyes widened, and she watched. "I will be gentle," he vowed. "I promise you." "I'm not worried," she said, managing a wobbly smile. His lips curved in return. "You look worried." "I'm not." But still, her eyes wandered. Gregory chuckled, lying down beside her. "It might hurt. I'm told it does at the beginning." She shook her head. "I don't care." He let his hand wander down her arm. "Just remember, if there is pain, it will get better." She felt it beginning again, that slow burning in her belly. "How much better?" she asked, her voice breathy and unfamiliar. He smiled as his fingers found her hip. "Quite a bit, I'm told." "Quite a bit?" she asked, now barely able to speak. "Or rather, a lot." He moved over her, his skin finding every inch of hers. "It was wicked. It was bliss." "Rather a lot," he answered, nipping lightly at her neck. "More than rather a lot, actually." She felt her legs slide open, and his body nestled in the space between them. She could feel him, hard and hot and pressing against her. She stiffened, and he must have felt it, because his lips crooned a soft shh at her ear. From there, he moved down, and down, and down. His mouth trailed fire along her neck to the hollow of her shoulder, and then, oh dear God, his hand was cupping her breast, making it round and plump, and his mouth found the tip. She jerked beneath him. He chuckled, and his other hand found her shoulder, holding her immobile while he continued his torture, pausing only to move to the other side. "Gregory," Lucy whimpered, because she did not know what else to say. She was lost to the sensation, completely helpless against his sensual onslaught. She couldn't explain, she couldn't fix or rationalize, she could only feel, and it was the most terrifying, thrilling thing imaginable. With one last nip, he released her breast and brought his face back up to hers. His breathing was ragged, his muscles tense. "Touch me," he said hoarsely. Her lips parted, and her eyes found his. "Anywhere," he begged. It was only then that Lucy realized that her hands were at her sides, gripping the sheets as if they could keep her sane. "I'm sorry," she said. And then, amazingly, she began to laugh. One side of his mouth curved up. "We're going to have to break you of that habit," he murmured. She brought her hands to his back, lightly exploring his skin. "You don't want me to apologize?" she asked. When he joked, when he teased, it made her comfortable. It made her bold. "Not for this," he groaned. She rubbed her feet against his calves. "Ever?" And then his hands started doing unspeakable things. "Do you want me to apologize?" "No," she gasped. He was touching her intimately, in ways she did not know she could be touched. It should have been the most awful thing in the world. But it wasn't. It made her stretch, arch, squirm. She had no idea what it was she was feeling. She couldn't have described it with Shakespeare himself at her disposal. But she wanted more. It was her only thought, the only thing she knew. Gregory was leading her somewhere. She felt pulled, taken, transported. And she wanted it all. Please, she begged, the words slipping unbidden from her lips. Please. But Gregory, too, was beyond words. He said her name. Over and over he said it, as if his lips had lost the memory of anything else. Lucy, he whispered, his mouth moving to the hollow between her breasts. Lucy, he moaned, slipping one finger inside of her, and then he gasped it. Lucy! She had touched him, softly, tentatively. But it was she. It was her hand, her caress. And it felt as if he'd been set on fire. I'm sorry, she said, yanking her hand away. Don't apologize, he ground out, not because he was angry, but because he could barely speak. He found her hand and dragged it back. This is how much I want you, he said, wrapping her around him. With everything I have, everything I am. His nose was barely an inch from hers. Their breath mingled, and their eyes, it was like they were one. I love you, he murmured, moving into position. Her hand slid away, then moved to his back. I love you, too, she whispered, and then her eyes widened, as if she were stunned that she'd said it. But he didn't care. It didn't matter if she'd meant to tell him or not. She'd said it, and she could never take it back. She was his, and he was hers. As he held himself still, pressing ever so softly at her entrance, he realized that he was at the edge of a precipice. His life was now one of two parts, before and after. He would never love another woman again. He could never love another woman again. Not after this, not as long as Lucy walked the same earth, there could be no one else. It was terrifying, this precipice. Terrifying and thrilling, and he jumped. She let out a little gasp as he pushed forward, but when he looked down at her, she did not seem to be in pain. Her head was thrown back, and each breath was accompanied by a little moan, as if she could not quite keep her desire inside. Her legs wrapped around his, feet running down the length of his calves, and her hips were arching, pressing, begging him to continue. I don't want to hurt you, he said, every muscle in his body straining to move forward. He had never wanted anything the way he wanted her in that moment, and yet he had never felt less greedy. This had to be for her. He could not hurt her. You're not, she groaned. And then he couldn't help himself. He captured her breast in his mouth as he pushed through her final barrier, embedding himself fully within her. If she'd felt pain, she didn't care. She let out a quiet shriek of pleasure, and her hands grabbed wildly at his head. She writhed beneath him, and when he attempted to move to her other breast, her fingers grew merciless, holding him in the place with a ferocious intensity. And all the while, his body claiming her, moving in a rhythm that was beyond thought or control. Lucy, 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 he moaned, finally tearing himself away from her breast. It was too hard. It was too much. He needed room to breathe, to gasp, to suck in the air that never quite seemed to make it to his lungs. Lucy! He should wait. He was trying to wait. But she was grabbing at him, digging her nails into his shoulders, and her body was arching off the bed with enough strength to lift him as well. And then he felt her, tensing, squeezing, shuddering around him. And he let go. He let go, and the world quite simply exploded. I love you, he gasped as he collapsed atop her. He thought himself beyond words, but there they were. They were his companions now. Three little words. I love you. He would never be without them. And that was a splendid thing. Chapter 20, in which our hero has a very bad morning. Sometime later, after sleep, and then more passion, and then not quite sleep, but a peaceful quiet and stillness, and then more passion, because they could not help themselves, it was time for Gregory to go. It was the most difficult thing he had ever done, and yet he was still able to do it with joy in his heart, because he knew that this was not the end. It was not even goodbye. It was nothing so permanent as that. But the hour was growing dangerous. Dawn would arrive shortly, and while he had every intention of marrying Lucy as soon as he could manage it, he would not put her through the shame of being caught in bed with him on the morning of her wedding to another man. There was also Hazelby to consider. Gregory did not know him well, but he had always seemed an affable fellow, and did not deserve the public humiliation that would follow. "Lucy," Gregory whispered, nudging her cheek with his nose, "it is near to morning." She made a sleepy sound, then turned her head. "Yes," she said. "Just, yes. Not, it's all so unfair, or it shouldn't have to be this way." But that was Lucy. She was pragmatic and prudent and charmingly reasonable, and he loved her for all that and more. She didn't want to change the world. She just wanted to make it lovely and wonderful for the people she loved. The fact that she had done this, that she had let him make love to her and was planning to call off her wedding now, the very morning of the ceremony, it only showed him how deeply she cared for him. Lucy didn't look for attention and drama. She craved stability and routine, and for her to make the leap she was preparing for, it humbled him. "You should come with me," he said. "Now. We should leave together before the household wakes." Her bottom lip stretched a bit from side to side in a oh-dearish expression that was so fetching he simply had to kiss her. Lightly, since he had no time to get carried away, and just a little peck on the corner of her mouth. Nothing that interfered with her answer, which was a disappointing, "I cannot." He drew back. "You cannot remain." But she was shaking her head. I must do the right thing." He looked at her quizzically. "I must behave with honor," she explained. She sat then, her fingers clutching the bedclothes so tightly that her knuckles turned white. She looked nervous, which he supposed made sense. He felt on the edge of a brand new dawn, whereas she still had a rather large mountain to scale before she could reach her happy ending. He reached out, trying to take one of her hands, but she was not receptive. It wasn't that she was tugging away from him. Rather, it almost felt as if she was not even aware of his touch. "I cannot sneak away and allow Lord Hazelby to wait in vain at the church," she said, the words rushing out, tumbling from her lips, as her eyes turned to his, wide and imploring. But just for a moment. Then she turned away. She swallowed. He could not see her face, but he could see it in the way she moved. She said softly, "Surely you understand that." And he did. It was one of the things he loved best about her. She had such a strong sense of right and wrong, sometimes to the point of intractability, but she was never moralistic, never condescending. "I will watch for you," he said. Her head turned sharply, and her eyes widened in question. "You may need my assistance," he said softly. "No, it won't be necessary. I'm sure I can—" "I insist," he said, with enough force to silence her. "This shall be our signal." He held up his hand, fingers together, palm out. He twisted at the wrist, then once to bring his palm around to face him, then again to return it to its original position. "I shall watch for you. If you need my help, come to the window and make the signal." She opened her mouth, as if she might protest one more time, but in the end she merely nodded. He stood then, opened the heavy draperies that ringed her bed as he searched for his clothing. His garments were strewn about, his breeches here, his shirt remarkably over there, but he quickly gathered what he needed and dressed. Lucy remained in bed, sitting up with the sheets tucked under her arm. He found her modesty charming, and he almost teased her for it. But instead, he decided just to offer an amused smile. It had been a momentous night for her. She should not be made to feel embarrassed for her innocence. He walked to the window to peer out. Dawn had not yet broken, but the sky hung with anticipation, the horizon painted with that faint shimmer of light one saw only before the sunrise. It glowed gently, a serene purplish blue, and was so beautiful he beckoned her to join him. He turned his back while she donned her nightgown, and then once she had padded across the room in her bare feet, he pulled her gently against him, her back to his chest, he rested his chin on top of her head. "Look," he whispered. The night seemed to dance, sparkling and tingling, as if the air itself understood that nothing would ever be the same. Dawn was waiting on the other side of the horizon, and already the stars were beginning to look less bright in the sky. If he could have frozen time, he would have done so. Never had he experienced a single moment that was so magical, so full. Everything was there, everything that was good and honest and true. And he finally understood the difference between happiness and contentment, and how lucky and blessed he was to feel both in such breathtaking quantities. It was Lucy. She completed him. She made his life everything he had known it could someday be. This was his dream. It was coming true, all around him, right there in his arms. And then, right as they were standing at the window, one of the stars shot through the sky. It made a wide, shallow arc, and it almost seemed to Gregory that he heard it as it travelled, sparking and crackling until it disappeared from sight. It made him kiss her. He supposed a rainbow would do the same, or a four-leafed clover, or even a simple snowflake landing on his sleeve without melting. It was simply impossible to enjoy one of nature's small miracles and not kiss her. He kissed her neck, and then he turned her around in his arms so that he could kiss her mouth and her brow and even her nose. All seven freckles, too. God, he loved her freckles. "I love you," he whispered. She laid her cheek against his chest, and her voice was hoarse, almost choked, as she said, "I love you, too." "Well, you certainly will not come with me now." He knew her answer, but he asked anyway. As expected, she nodded. "I must do this myself."
"How will your uncle react?"
"I'm not sure."
He stepped back, taking her by the shoulders, and even bending at the knees so that his eyes would not lose contact with hers.
"Will he hurt you?"
"No," she said, quickly enough so that he believed her. "No, I promise you."
"Will he try to force you to marry Hazelby? Lock you in your room? Because I could stay. If you think you will need me, I could remain right here."
It would create an even worse scandal than what currently lay ahead for them. But if it was a question of her safety, there was nothing he would not do.
"Gregory."
He silenced her with a shake of his head.
"Do you understand," he began, "how completely and utterly this goes against my every instinct, leaving you here to face this by yourself?"
Her lips parted, and her eyes, they filled with tears.
"I have sworn in my heart to protect you," he said, his voice passionate and fierce, and maybe even a little bit revelatory, because today, he realized, was the day he truly became a man. After 26 years of an amiable and, yes, aimless existence, he had finally found his purpose. He finally knew why he had been born. "I have sworn it in my heart," he said, "and I will swear it before God just as soon as we are able. And it is like acid in my chest to leave you alone." His hand found hers, and their fingers twined.
"It is not right," he said, his words low but fierce.
Slowly she nodded her agreement.
"But it is what must be done. If there is a problem," he said, "if you sense danger, you must promise to signal. I will come for you. You can take refuge with my mother or any one of my sisters. They won't mind the scandal. They would care only for your happiness."
She swallowed, and then she smiled, and her eyes grew wistful.
"Your family must be lovely."
He took her hands and squeezed them.
"They are your family now."
He waited for her to say something, but she did not. He brought her hands to his lips and kissed them each in turn.
"Soon," he whispered, "this will be all behind us."
She nodded, then glanced over her shoulder at the door.
"The servants will be waking shortly."
And he left. He slipped out the door, boots in hand, and crept out the way he'd come in. It was still dark when he reached the small park that filled the square across from her home. There were hours yet before the wedding, and surely he had enough time to return home to change his clothing. But he was not prepared to chance it. He had told her he would protect her, and he would never break that promise. But then it occurred to him he did not need to do this alone. In fact, he should not do it alone. If Lucy needed him, she would need him well and full. If Gregory had to resort to force, he could certainly use an extra set of hands. He had never gone to his brothers for help, never begged them to extricate him from a tight spot. He was a relatively young man. He drank spirits, gambled, dallied with women, but he had never drunk too much or gambled more than he had, or, until the previous night, dallied with a woman who risked her reputation to be with him. He had not sought responsibility, but neither had he chased trouble. His brothers had always seen him as a boy. Even now, in his 26th year, he suspected they did not view him as quite fully grown, and so he did not ask for help. He did not place himself in a position where he might need it. Until now. One of his older brothers lived not very far away, less than a quarter of a mile, certainly maybe even closer to an eighth. Gregory could be there and back in 20 minutes, including the time it took to yank Colin from his bed. Gregory had just rolled his shoulders back and forth, loosening up in preparation for a sprint, when he spied a chimney sweep walking across the street. He was young, 12, maybe 13, and certainly eager for a guinea, and the promise of another should he deliver Gregory's message to his brother. Gregory watched him tear around the corner. Then he crossed back to the public garden. There was no place to sit, no place even to stand, where he might not be immediately visible from Fensworth House. And so he climbed a tree. He sat on a low, thick branch, leaned against the trunk, and waited. Some day, he told himself, he would laugh about this. Some day they would tell this tale to their grandchildren, and it would all sound very romantic and exciting. As for now, romantic, yes. Exciting, not so much. He rubbed his hands together. Most of all, it was cold. He shrugged, waiting for himself to stop noticing it. He never did, but he didn't care. What were a few blue fingertips against the rest of his life? He smiled, lifting his gaze to her window. There she was, he thought. Right there behind that curtain. And he loved her. He loved her. He thought of his friends, most of them cynics, always casting a bored eye over the latest selection of debutantes, sighing that marriage was such a chore, that ladies were interchangeable, and that love was best left to the poets. Fools, the lot of them. Love existed. It was right there in the air, in the wind, in the water. One only had to wait for it, to watch for it, and fight for it. And he would. As God was his witness, he would. Lucy had only to signal, and he would retrieve her. He was a man in love. Nothing could stop him. "This is not, you realize, how I intended to spend my Saturday morning," Gregory answered only with a nod. His brother had arrived 4 hours earlier, greeting him with a characteristically understated, "This is interesting." Gregory had told Colin everything, even down to the events of the night before. He did not like telling tales of Lucy, but one really could not ask one's brother to sit in a tree for hours without explaining why. And Gregory had found a certain comfort in unburdening himself to Colin. He had not lectured. He had not judged. In fact, he had understood. When Gregory had finished his tale, tersely explaining why he was waiting outside Fensworth House, Colin had simply nodded and said, "I don't suppose you have something to eat." Gregory shook his head and grinned. It was good to have a brother. "Rather poor planning on your part," Colin muttered, but he was smiling too. They turned back to the house, which had long since begun to show signs of life. Curtains had been pulled back, candles lit and then snuffed as dawn had given way to morning. "Shouldn't she have come out by now?" Colin asked, squinting at the door. Gregory frowned. He'd been wondering the same thing. He'd been telling himself that her absence boded well. If her uncle was going to force her to marry Hazelby, wouldn't she have left for the church by now? By his pocket watch, which admittedly wasn't the most accurate of timepieces, the ceremony was due to begin in less than an hour. But she had not signalled for his help either, and that did not sit well with him. Suddenly Colin perked up. "What is it?" Colin motioned to the right with his head. "A carriage," he said, "being brought round from the mews." Gregory's eyes widened with horror as the front door to Fensworth House opened,
Servants spilled out, laughing and cheering, as the vehicle came to a stop in front of Fensworth House. It was white, open, and festooned with perfectly pink flowers and wide rosy ribbons trailing behind, fluttering in the light breeze. It was a wedding carriage, and no one seemed to find that odd. Gregory's skin began to tingle. His muscles burned.
"Not yet,"
Colin said, placing a restraining hand on Gregory's arm. Gregory shook his head. His peripheral vision was beginning to fade from view, and all he could see was that damned carriage.
"I have to get her," he said. "I have to go."
"Wait," Colin instructed.
"Wait to see what happens. She might not come out. She might..."
But she did come out. Not first. That was her brother, his new wife on his arm. Then came an older man, her uncle most probably, and that ancient woman Gregory had met at his sister's ball. And then... Lucy. In a wedding dress.
"Dear God," he whispered.
She was walking freely. No one was forcing her. Hermione said something to her, whispered in her ear, and Lucy smiled.
She smiled.
Gregory began to gasp. The pain was palpable, real. It shot through his gut, squeezed at his organs until he could no longer move. He could only stare and think.
"Did she tell you she wasn't going to go through with it?" Colin whispered.
Gregory tried to say yes, but the word strangled him. He tried to recall their last conversation, every last word of it. She had said that she must behave with honour. She had said she must do what was right. She had said that she loved him. But she had never said that she would not marry Hazelby.
"Oh, my God," he whispered.
His brother laid his hand over his own.
"I'm sorry," he said.
Gregory watched as Lucy stepped up into the open carriage. The servants were still cheering. Hermione was fussing with her hair, adjusting the veil, then laughing when the wind lifted the gauzy fabric in the air. This could not be happening. There had to be an explanation.
"No,"
Gregory said, because it was the only word he could think to say.
"No."
Then he remembered. The hand signal, the wave. She would do it. She would signal to him. Whatever had transpired in the house, she had not been able to halt the proceedings. But now, out in the open, where he could see her, she would signal. She had to. She knew he could see her. She knew he was out there, watching her. He swallowed convulsively, never taking his eyes off her right hand. "Is everyone here?" he heard Lucy's brother call out. He did not hear Lucy's voice in the chorus of replies, but no one was questioning her presence. She was the bride. And he was a fool watching her ride away.
"I'm sorry," Colin said quietly as they watched the carriage disappear around the corner.
"It doesn't make sense," Gregory whispered. Colin jumped down out of the tree and silently held out his hand to Gregory.
"It doesn't make sense,"
Gregory said again, too bewildered to do anything but let his brother help him down.
"She wouldn't do this. She loves me."
He looked at Colin. His eyes were kind but pitying.
"No," Gregory said. "No, you don't know her. She would not. No, you don't know her."
And Colin, whose only experience with Lady Lucinda Abernathy was the moment in which she had broken his brother's heart, asked, "Do you know her?" Gregory stepped back as if struck.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I do."
Colin didn't say anything, but his brows rose as if to ask,
"Well, then?"
Gregory turned, his eyes moving to the corner around which Lucy had so recently disappeared. For a moment he stood absolutely still, his only movement a deliberate, thoughtful blink of his eyes. He turned back around, looked at his brother in the face.
"I know her," he said. "I do."
Colin's lips drew together, as if trying to form a question. But Gregory had already turned away. He was looking at that corner again. And then he began to run. Chapter 21, in which our hero risks everything.
"Are you ready?"
Lucy regarded the splendid interior of St. George's, the bright stained glass, the elegant arches, the piles and piles of flowers brought in to celebrate her marriage. She thought about Lord Hazelby standing with the priest at the altar. She thought about the guests, all more than 300 of them, all waiting for her to enter on her brother's arm. And she thought about Gregory, who had surely seen her climb up into the bridal carriage, dressed in her wedding finery.
"Lucy,"
Hermione repeated,
"are you ready?"
Lucy wondered what Hermione might do if she said no. Hermione was a romantic, impractical. She would probably tell Lucy that she did not have to go through with it, that it did not matter that they were standing just outside the doors to the church sanctuary, or that the Prime Minister himself was seated inside. Hermione would tell her that it did not matter that papers had been signed and banns had been read in 3 different parishes. It did not matter that by fleeing the church, Lucy would create the scandal of the decade. She would tell Lucy that she did not have to do it, that she should not settle for a marriage of convenience when she could have one of passion and love. She would say,
"Lucy,"
is what she actually said. Lucy turned, blinking in confusion, because the Hermione of her imagination had been giving quite an impassioned speech. Hermione smiled gently.
"Are you ready?"
And Lucy, because she was Lucy, because she would always be Lucy, nodded. She could do nothing else. Richard joined them. "I cannot believe you're getting married," he said to Lucy, but not before gazing warmly at his wife. "I'm not so very much younger than you are, Richard," Lucy reminded him. She tilted her head toward the new Lady Fensworth. "And I am 2 months older than Hermione." Richard grinned boyishly. "Yes, but she is not my sister." Lucy smiled at that, and she was grateful for it. She needed smiles, every last one she could manage. It was her wedding day. She had been bathed and perfumed and dressed in what had to be the most luxurious gown she had ever laid eyes upon, and she felt empty. She could not imagine what Gregory thought of her. She had deliberately allowed him to think that she planned to call off the wedding. It was terrible of her, cruel and dishonest, but she did not know what else to do. She was a coward, and she could not bear to see his face when she told him she still intended to marry Hazelby. Good God, how could she have explained it? He would have insisted that there was another way, but he was an idealist and he had never faced true adversity. There wasn't another way, not this time. Not without sacrificing her family. She let out a long breath. She could do this. Truly, she could. She could. She closed her eyes, her head bobbing a half inch or so as the words echoed in her mind. "I can do this. I can. I can."
"Lucy,"
came Hermione's concerned voice.
"Are you unwell?"
Lucy opened her eyes, and said the only thing Hermione would possibly believe.
"Just doing sums in my head."
Hermione shook her head.
"I hope Lord Hazelby likes maths, because I vow, Lucy, you are mad."
"Perhaps." Hermione looked at her quizzically.
"What is it?"
Lucy asked. Hermione blinked several times before finally replying.
"It's nothing, really," she said. "Just that sounded quite unlike you."
"I don't know what you mean."
"To agree with me when I call you mad. That's not at all what you would say."
"Well, it's obviously what I did say," Lucy grumbled. "So I don't know what...
Oh, pish. The Lucy I know would say something like, 'Mathematics is a very extremely important endeavour, and really, Hermione, you ought to consider practising sums yourself.'"
Lucy winced.
"Am I truly so officious?"
"Yes," Hermione replied, as if she were mad even to question it.
"But it's what I love best about you."
And Lucy managed another smile. Maybe everything would be all right. Maybe she would be happy. If she could manage 2 smiles in 1 morning, then surely it couldn't be that bad. She needed only to keep moving forward in her mind and her body. She needed to have this thing done, to make it permanent, so she could place Gregory in her past and at least pretend to embrace her new life as Lord Hazelby's wife. But Hermione was asking Richard if she might have a moment alone with Lucy, and then she was taking her hands, leaning in and whispering,
"Lucy, are you certain you wish to do this?"
Lucy looked up at her in surprise. Why was Hermione asking her this, right at the moment when she most wanted to run? Hadn't she been smiling? Hadn't Hermione seen her smiling? Lucy swallowed. She tried to straighten her shoulders.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, of course. Why would you ask such a thing?"
Hermione did not answer right away, but her eyes, those huge green eyes that rendered grown men senseless, they answered for her. Lucy swallowed and turned away, unable to bear what she saw there. And Hermione whispered,
"Lucy."
That was all. Just Lucy. Lucy turned back. She wanted to ask Hermione what she meant. She wanted to ask why she said her name as if it were a tragedy. But she didn't. She couldn't. And so she hoped Hermione saw her questions in her eyes. She did. Hermione touched her cheek, smiling sadly.
"You look like the saddest bride I've ever seen."
Lucy closed her eyes.
"I'm not sad. I just feel..."
But she didn't know what she felt. What was she supposed to feel? No one had trained her for this. In all her education with her nurses and governess, and 3 years at Miss Moss's, no one had given her lessons in this. Why hadn't anyone realized that this was far more important than needlework or country dances?
"I feel..."
And then she understood.
"I feel like I'm saying goodbye."
Hermione blinked with surprise. "To whom?" "To myself." And she was. She was saying goodbye to herself and everything she might have become. She felt her brother's hand on her arm.
"It's time to begin," he said.
She nodded.
"Where's your bouquet?"
Hermione asked, then answered herself with,
"Oh, right there."
She retrieved the flowers, along with her own, from a nearby table, and handed them to Lucy.
"You shall be happy," she whispered, as she kissed Lucy's cheek. "You must. I simply will not tolerate a world in which you are not."
Lucy's lips wobbled.
"Oh, dear," Hermione said. "I sound like you now. Do you see what a good influence you are?"
And then, with one last blown kiss, she entered the chapel.
"Your turn,"
Richard said.
"Almost,"
Lucy answered. And then it was. She was in the church, walking down the aisle. She was at the front, nodding at the priest, looking at Hazelby and reminding herself that despite, well, despite certain habits she did not quite understand, he would make a perfectly acceptable husband. This was what she had to do. If she said no, she could not say no. She could see Hermione out of the corner of her eye, standing beside her with a serene smile. She and Richard had arrived in London 2 nights earlier, and they'd been so happy. They laughed and they teased and they spoke of the improvements they planned to make at Fensworth Abbey. An orangery, they had laughed. They wanted an orangery and a nursery. How could Lucy take that from them? How could she cast them into a life of shame and poverty? She heard Hazelby's voice answering, "I will." And then it was her turn.
"Wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou obey him and serve him, love, honour, and keep him in sickness and in health, and, forsaking all other, keep thee only unto him, so long as ye both shall live?"
She swallowed and tried not to think of Gregory. "I will."
She had given her consent. Was it done, then? She didn't feel different. She was still the same old Lucy, except she was standing in front of more people than she ever cared to stand in front of again, and her brother was giving her away. The priest placed her right hand in Hazelby's, and he pledged his troth, his voice loud, firm, and clear. They separated, and then Lucy took his hand.
"I, Lucinda Margaret Catherine..."
"I, Lucinda Margaret Catherine..."
Take thee, Arthur Fitzwilliam George.
Take thee, Arthur Fitzwilliam George.
She said it. She repeated after the priest, word for word. She said her part, right up until she meant to give Hazelby her troth, right up until the doors to the chapel slammed open. She turned around. Everyone turned around. Gregory! Dear God! He looked like a madman, breathing so hard he was barely able to speak. He staggered forward, clutching the edges of the pew for support, and she heard him say, "Don't!" Lucy's heart stopped.
"Don't do it!"
Her bouquet slipped from her hands. She couldn't move, couldn't speak, couldn't do anything but stand there like a statue as he walked toward her, seemingly oblivious to the hundreds of people staring at him.
"Don't do it," he said again. And no one was talking. Why was no one talking? Surely someone would rush forward, grab Gregory by the arms, haul him away. But no one did. It was a spectacle. It was theatre, and it seemed no one wanted to miss the ending. And then, right there in front of everyone, he stopped. He stopped, and he said, "I love you."
Beside her, Hermione murmured,
"Oh, my goodness."
Lucy wanted to cry.
"I love you,"
he said again, and he just kept walking, his eyes never leaving her face.
"Don't do it," he said, finally reaching the front of the church. "Don't marry him."
"Gregory," she whispered, "why are you doing this?"
"I love you," he said, as if there could be no other explanation.
A little moan choked in her throat. Tears burned her eyes, and her entire body felt stiff, stiff and frozen. One little wind, one little breath would knock her over, and she couldn't manage to think anything but why, and no, and please, and oh heavens, Lord Hazelby. She looked up at him, at the groom who had found himself demoted to a supporting role. He had been standing silently this entire time, watching the unfolding drama with as much interest as the audience. With her eyes she pleaded with him for guidance, but he just shook his head. It was a tiny movement, far too subtle for anyone else to discern, but she saw it, and she knew what it meant. "It is up to you." She turned back to Gregory. His eyes burned, and he sank to one knee.
"Don't," she tried to say, but she could not move her lips. She could not find her voice.
"Marry me," Gregory said, "Marry me." And oh, dear Lord, she wanted to.
More than anything, she wanted to sink to her knees and take his face in her hands. She wanted to kiss him. She wanted to shout out her love for him, here in front of everyone she knew, possibly everyone she ever would know. But she had wanted all of that the day before, and the day before that. Nothing had changed. Her world had become more public, but it had not changed. Her father was still a traitor. Her family was still being blackmailed. The fate of her brother and Hermione was still in her hands. She looked at Gregory, aching for him, aching for them both.
"Marry me," he whispered. Her lips parted, and she said, "No."
Chapter 22, in which all hell breaks loose. All hell broke loose. Lord Davenport charged forward, as did Lucy's uncle and Gregory's brother, who had just tripped up the steps to the church after chasing Gregory across Mayfair. Lucy's brother dashed forward to move both Lucy and Hermione from the melee, but Lord Hazelby, who had been watching the events with the air of an intrigued spectator, calmly took the arm of his intended and said,
"I will see to her."
As for Lucy, she stumbled backward, her mouth open with shock, as Lord Davenport leaped atop Gregory, landing belly down like a, well, like nothing Lucy had ever seen.
"I have him!"
Davenport yelled triumphantly, only to be smacked soundly with a reticule belonging to Hyacinth St. Clair. Lucy closed her eyes.
"Not the wedding of your dreams, I imagine."
Hazelby murmured in her ear. Lucy shook her head, too numb to do anything else. She should help Gregory. Really, she should. But she felt positively drained of energy, and besides, she was too cowardly to face him again. What if he rejected her? What if she could not resist him?
"I do hope he'll be able to get out from under my father," Hazelby continued, his tone as mild as if he were watching a not terribly exciting horse race. "The man weighs 20 stone, not that he would admit it."
Lucy turned to him, unable to believe how calm he was, given the near riot that had broken out in the church. Even the Prime Minister appeared to be fending off a largish, plumpish lady in an elaborately fruited bonnet who was swatting at anyone who moved.
"I don't think she can see," Hazelby said, following Lucy's gaze. "Her grapes are drooping."
Who was this man she had... Dear heavens, had she married him yet? They had agreed to something, of that she was certain, but no one had declared them man and wife. But either way, Hazelby was bizarrely calm, given the events of the morning. "Why didn't you say anything?" Lucy asked.
He turned, regarding her curiously. "You mean while your Mr. Bridgerton was professing his love?"
"No, while the priest was droning on about the sacrament of marriage," she wanted to snap. Instead, she nodded. Hazelby cocked his head to the side.
"I suppose I wanted to see what you do."
She stared at him in disbelief. What would he have done if she had said yes?
"I'm honored, by the way," Hazelby said, "and I shall be a kind husband to you. You needn't worry on that score."
But Lucy could not speak. Lord Davenport had been removed from Gregory, and even though some other gentleman she did not recognize was pulling him back, he was struggling to reach her. "Please," she whispered, even though no one could possibly hear her, not even Hazelby, who had stepped down to aid the Prime Minister. "Please, don't." But Gregory was unrelenting, and even with two men pulling at him, one friendly and one not, he managed to reach the bottom of the stairs. He lifted his face, and his eyes burned into hers. They were raw, stark with anguish and incomprehension, and Lucy nearly stumbled from the unleashed pain she saw there.
"Why?"
he demanded. Her entire body began to shake. Could she lie to him? Could she do it? Here in a church, after she had hurt him in the most personal and the most public way imaginable.
"Why?"
"Because I had to," she whispered. His eyes flared with something. Disappointment? No. Hope? No, not that either. It was something else, something she could not quite identify. He opened his mouth to speak, to ask her something, but it was at that moment that the two men holding him were joined by a third, and together they managed to haul him from the church. Lucy hugged her arms to her body, barely able to stand, as she watched him being dragged away.
"How could you?"
She turned. Hyacinth St. Clair had crept up behind her and was glaring at her as if she were the very devil.
"You don't understand," Lucy said,
but Hyacinth's eyes blazed with fury.
"You are weak," she hissed. "You do not deserve him."
Lucy shook her head, not quite sure if she was agreeing with her or not.
"I hope you..."
"Hyacinth?" Lucy's eyes darted to the side. Another woman had approached. It was Gregory's mother. They'd been introduced at the ball at Hastings House.
"That will be enough," she said sternly.
Lucy swallowed, blinking back tears. Lady Bridgerton turned to her.
"Forgive us," she said, pulling her daughter away.
Lucy watched them depart, and she had the strangest sense that all this was happening to someone else, that maybe it was just a dream, just a nightmare, or perhaps she was caught up in a scene from a lurid novel. Maybe her entire life was a figment of someone else's imagination. Maybe if she just closed her eyes...
"Shall we get on with it?"
She swallowed. It was Lord Hazelby. His father was next to him, uttering the same sentiment, but in far less gracious words. Lucy nodded.
"Good," Davenport grunted. "Sensible girl."
Lucy wondered what it meant to be complimented by Lord Davenport. Surely nothing good. But still she allowed him to lead her back to the altar, and she stood there in front of half of the congregation who had not elected to follow the spectacle outside, and she married Hazelby.
"What were you thinking?"
It took Gregory a moment to realize that his mother was demanding this of Colin, and not of him. They were seated in her carriage, to which he had been dragged once they'd left the church. Gregory did not know where they were going. In random circles, most probably. Anywhere that wasn't St. George's.
"I tried to stop him," Colin protested.
Violet Bridgerton looked as angry as any of them had ever seen her.
"You obviously did not try hard enough. Do you have any idea how fast he can run?"
"Very fast," Hyacinth confirmed, without looking at them. She was seated diagonally to Gregory, staring out the window through narrowed eyes. Gregory said nothing.
"Oh, Gregory," Violet sighed. "Oh, my poor son."
"You shall have to leave town," Hyacinth said.
"She's right," their mother put in. "It can't be helped." Gregory said nothing. What had Lucy meant? "Because I had to." What did that mean?
"I shall never receive her,"
Hyacinth growled.
"She will be a countess," Colin reminded her.
"I don't care if she's the bloody queen of Hyacinth."
This from her mother.
"Well, I don't," Hyacinth snapped. "No one has the right to treat my brother like that. No one."
Violet and Colin stared at her. Colin looked amused, Violet alarmed.
"I shall ruin her," Hyacinth continued.
"No," Gregory said in a low voice. "You won't."
The rest of his family fell silent, and Gregory suspected that they had not, until the moment he'd spoken, realized that he had not been taking part in the conversation.
"You will leave her alone," he said.
Hyacinth ground her teeth together. He brought his eyes to hers, hard and steely with purpose.
"And if your paths should ever cross," he continued, "you shall be all that is amiable and kind. Do you understand me?"
Hyacinth said nothing.
"Do you understand me?"
he roared. His family stared at him in shock. He had never lost his temper. Never. And then Hyacinth, who had never possessed a highly developed sense of tact, said,
"No, as a matter of fact."
"I beg your pardon,"
Gregory said, his voice dripping ice at the very moment Colin turned to her and hissed, "Shut up."
"I don't understand you,"
Hyacinth continued, jamming her elbow into Colin's ribs.
"How can you possibly possess sympathy for her? If this had happened to me, wouldn't you—"
"This didn't happen to you,"
Gregory bit off. "And you do not know her. You do not know the reasons for her actions."
"Do you?"
Hyacinth demanded.
He didn't. And it was killing him. "Turn the other cheek, Hyacinth," her mother said softly.
Hyacinth sat back, her bearing tense with anger, but she held her tongue.
"Perhaps you could stay with Benedict and Sophie in Wiltshire," Violet suggested. "I believe Anthony and Kate are expected in town soon, so you cannot go to Aubrey Hall, although I am sure they would not mind if you resided there in their absence."
Gregory just stared out the window. He did not wish to go to the country.
"You could travel," Colin said.
"Italy is particularly pleasant this time of year, and you haven't been, have you?"
Gregory shook his head, only half listening. He did not wish to go to Italy.
"Because I had to," she'd said. Not because she wished it, not because it was sensible. Because she had to. What did that mean? Had she been forced? Was she being blackmailed? What could she have possibly done to warrant blackmail?
"It would have been very difficult for her not to go through with it," Violet suddenly said, placing a sympathetic hand on his arm. "Lord Davenport is not a man anyone would wish as an enemy. And really, right there in the church, with everyone looking on."
"Well," she said with a resigned sigh, "one would have to be extremely brave and resilient."
She paused, shaking her head.
"And prepared."
"Prepared?" Colin queried.
"For what came next?" Violet clarified. "It would have been a huge scandal."
"It already is a huge scandal," Gregory muttered.
"Yes, but not as much as if she'd said yes," his mother said. "Not that I am glad for the outcome. You know I wish you nothing but your heart's happiness. But she will be looked upon approvingly for her choice. She will be viewed as a sensible girl."
Gregory felt one corner of his mouth lift into a wry smile.
"And I, a lovesick fool,"
No one contradicted him. After a moment, his mother said,
"You are taking this rather well, I must say."
"Indeed.
I would have thought..." She broke off.
"Well, it matters not what I would have thought, merely what actually is."
"No," Gregory said, turning sharply to look at her.
"What would you have thought? How should I be acting?"
"It's not a question of should," his mother said, clearly flustered by the sudden questions. "Merely that I would have thought you would seem angrier."
He stared at her for a long moment, then turned back to the window. They were travelling along Piccadilly, heading west towards Hyde Park. Why wasn't he angrier? Why wasn't he putting his fist through the wall? He'd had to be dragged from the church and forcibly stuffed into the carriage, but once that had been done, he had been overcome by a bizarre, almost preternatural calm. And then something his mother had said echoed in his mind. "You know I wish you nothing but your heart's happiness." His heart's happiness. Lucy loved him. He was certain of it. He had seen it in her eyes, even in the moment she refused him. He knew it because she had told him so, and she did not lie about such things. He had felt it in the way she had kissed him and in the warmth of her embrace. She loved him, and whatever had made her go ahead with her marriage to Hazelby, it was bigger than she was, stronger. She needed his help. "Gregory?" his mother said softly. He turned, blinked.
"You started in your seat," she said.
Had he? He hadn't even noticed. But his senses had sharpened, and when he looked down, he saw that he was flexing his fingers. "Stop the carriage." Everyone turned to face him, even Hyacinth, who had been determinedly glaring out of the window. "Stop the carriage," he said again.
"Why?"
his mother asked, clearly suspicious.
"I need air," he replied, and it wasn't even a lie.
Colin knocked on the wall.
"I'll walk with you."
"No, I prefer to be alone." His mother's eyes widened.
"Gregory, you don't plan to
storm the church?" he finished for her. He leaned back, giving her a casually lopsided smile. "I believe I've embarrassed myself enough for one day, wouldn't you think?"
"They'll have said their vows by now, anyway," Hyacinth put in.
Gregory fought the urge to glare at his sister, who never seemed to miss an opportunity to poke, prod, or twist.
"Precisely," he replied. "I would feel better if you weren't alone," Violet said, her blue eyes still filled with concern.
"Let him go," Colin said softly. Gregory turned to his older brother in surprise. He had not expected to be championed by him.
"He is a man," Colin added. "He can make his own decisions."
Even Hyacinth did not attempt to contradict. The carriage had already come to a halt, and the driver was waiting outside the door. At Colin's nod, he opened it.
"I wish you wouldn't go," Violet said.
Gregory kissed her cheek.
"I need air," he said. "That is all."
He hopped down, but before he could shut the door, Colin leaned out.
"Don't do anything foolish," Colin said quietly.
"Nothing foolish," Gregory promised him.
"Only what is necessary."
He took stock of his location, and then, as his mother's carriage had not moved, deliberately set off to the south, away from St. George's. But once he reached the next street, he doubled around, running. Chapter 23, in which our hero risks everything again. In the 10 years since her uncle had become her guardian, Lucy had never known him to host a party. He was not one to smile upon any sort of unnecessary expense. In truth, he was not one to smile at all. So it was with some suspicion that she approached the lavish fete being thrown in her honour at Fensworth House following the wedding ceremony. Lord Davenport had surely insisted upon it. Uncle Robert would have been content to serve tea cakes at the church and be done with it. But no, the wedding must be an event, in the most extravagant sense of the word. And so as soon as the ceremony was over, Lucy was whisked to her soon-be former home and given just enough time in her soon-to-be former bedchamber to splash some cool water on her face
before she was summoned to greet her guests below. It was remarkable, she thought, as she nodded and received the well wishes of the attendees, just how good the ton was at pretending nothing had happened. Oh, they would be speaking of nothing else tomorrow, and she could probably look forward to being the main topic of conversation for the next few months, even. And certainly for the next year, no one would say her name without appending, "Oh, you know the one, with the wedding," which would surely be followed by, "Oh, she's the one." But for now, to her face, there was nothing but, "Such a happy occasion," and, "You make a beautiful bride," and of course, for the sly and daring, "A lovely ceremony, Lady Hazelby." Lady Hazelby. She tested it out in her mind. She was Lady Hazelby now. She could have been Mrs. Bridgerton. Lady Lucinda Bridgerton, she supposed, as she was not required to surrender her honorific upon marriage to a commoner. It was a nice name, not as lofty as Lady Hazelby, perhaps, and certainly nothing compared to the Countess of Davenport. But she swallowed, somehow managing not to dislodge the smile she'd affixed to her face 5 minutes earlier. She would have liked to have been Lady Lucinda Bridgerton. She liked Lady Lucinda Bridgerton. She was a happy sort, with a ready smile and a life that was full and complete. She had a dog, maybe two, and several children. Her house was warm and cozy, she drank tea with her friends, and she laughed. Lady Lucinda Bridgerton laughed. But she would never be that woman. She had married Lord Hazelby, and now she was his wife. And try as she might, she could not picture where her life might lead. She did not know what it meant to be Lady Hazelby. The party hummed along, and Lucy danced her obligatory dance with her new husband, who was, she was relieved to note, quite accomplished. Then she danced with her brother, which nearly made her cry, and then her uncle, because it was expected.
"You did the right thing, Lucy," he said.
She said nothing. She didn't trust herself to do so.
"I'm proud of you."
She almost laughed. "You have never been proud of me before."
"I am now."
It did not escape her notice that this was not a contradiction. Her uncle returned her to the side of the ballroom floor, and then, dear God, she had to dance with Lord Davenport, which she did because she knew her duty. On this day, especially, she knew her duty. At least she did not have to speak. Lord Davenport was at his most effusive, and more than carried the conversation for both of them. He was delighted with Lucy. She was a magnificent asset to the family, and so on and so forth, until Lucy realized that she had managed to endear herself to him in the most indelible manner possible. She had not simply agreed to marry his dubiously reputationed son. She had affirmed the decision in front of the entire ton of a scene worthy of Drury Lane. Lucy moved her head discreetly to one side. When Lord Davenport was excited, spittle tended to fly from his mouth with alarming speed and accuracy. Truly, she wasn't sure which was worse, Lord Davenport's disdain or his everlasting gratitude. But Lucy managed to avoid her new father-in-law for most of the festivities, thank heavens. She managed to avoid most everyone, which was surprisingly undifficult, given that she was the bride. She didn't want to see Lord Davenport because she detested him, and she didn't want to see her uncle because she rather suspected she detested him as well. She didn't want to see Lord Hazelby, because that would only lead to thoughts of her upcoming wedding night. And she didn't want to see Hermione, because she would ask questions, and then Lucy would cry. And she didn't want to see her brother, because he was sure to be with Hermione. And besides that, she was feeling rather bitter, alternating with feeling rather guilty for feeling bitter. It wasn't Richard's fault that he was deliriously happy, and she was not. But all the same, she'd rather not have to see him. Which left the guests, most of whom she did not know, and none of whom she wished to meet. So she found a spot in the corner, and after a couple of hours, everyone had drunk so much that no one seemed to notice that the bride was sitting by herself. And certainly no one took note when she escaped to her bedchamber to take a short rest. It was probably very bad manners for a bride to avoid her own party, but at that moment, Lucy simply did not care. People would think she'd gone off to relieve herself if anyone noticed her absence, and somehow it seemed appropriate for her to be alone on this day. She slipped up the back stairs, lest she come across any wandering guests, and with a sigh of relief she stepped into her room and shut the door behind her. She leaned her back against the door, slowly deflating until it felt like there was nothing left within her. And she thought, "Now I shall cry." She wanted to. Truly she did. She felt as if she'd been holding it inside for hours, just waiting for a private moment. But the tears would not come. She was too numb, too dazed by the events of the last 24 hours. And so she stood there, staring at her bed, remembering. Dear heaven, had it been only 12 hours earlier that she had lain there wrapped in his arms? It seemed like years. It was as if her life were now neatly divided in two, and she was most firmly in after. She closed her eyes. Maybe if she didn't see it, it would go away. Maybe if she... Lucy. She froze. Dear God, no. Lucy. Slowly she opened her eyes and whispered. Gregory? He looked a mess, windblown and dirty as only a mad ride on horseback could do to a man. He must have sneaked in the same way he'd done the night before. He must have been waiting for her. She opened her mouth, tried to speak. Lucy, he said again, and his voice flowed through her, melted around her. She swallowed. Why are you here? He stepped forward, and her heart just ached from it. His face was so handsome, and so dear, and so perfectly, wonderfully familiar. She knew the slope of his cheeks and the exact shade of his eyes, brownish near the iris, melting into green at the edge. And his mouth. She knew that mouth, the look of it, the feel of it. She knew his smile, and she knew his frown, and she knew far too much. You shouldn't be here, she said, the catch in her voice belying the stillness of her posture. He took another step in her direction. There was no anger in his eyes, which she did not understand, but the way he was looking at her. It was hot, and it was possessive, and it was nothing like a married woman should ever allow from a man who was not her husband. I had to know why, he said. I couldn't let you go. Not until I knew why. Don't, she whispered. Please, don't do this. Please don't make me regret. Please don't make me long and wish and wonder. She hugged her arms to her chest, as if maybe she could squeeze so tight that she could pull herself inside out. And then she wouldn't have to see. She wouldn't have to hear. She could just be alone and... Lucy, don't, she said again, sharply this time. Don't. Don't make me believe in love. But he moved ever closer, slowly but without hesitation. Lucy, he said, his voice warm and full of purpose. Just tell me why. That is all I ask. I will walk away and promise never to approach you again, but I must know why. She shook her head. I can't tell you. You won't tell me, he corrected. No, she cried out, choking on the word. I can't. Please, Gregory, you must go. For a long moment he said nothing. He just watched her face, and she could practically see him thinking. She shouldn't allow this, she thought, a bubble of panic beginning to rise within her. She should scream, have him ejected. She should run from the room before he could ruin her careful plans for the future. But instead, she just stood there, and he said, "You're being blackmailed." It wasn't a question. She did not answer, but she knew that her face gave her away. "Lucy," he said, his voice soft and careful, "I can help you. Whatever it is, I can make it right." "No," she said, "you can't, and you're a fool to..." She cut herself off, too furious to speak. What made him think he could rush in and fix things when he knew nothing of her travails? Did he think she had given him for something small, something that could be easily overcome? She was not that weak. "You don't know," she said. "You have no idea." "Then tell me." Her muscles were shaking, and she felt hot, cold, everything in between. "Lucy," he said, and his voice was so calm, so even, It was like a fork poking her right where she could least tolerate it.
"You can't fix this," she ground out.
"That is not true. There is nothing anyone could hold over you that could not be overcome."
"By what?" she demanded. "Rainbows and sprites and the everlasting good wishes of your family? It won't work, Gregory, it won't. The Bridgertons may be powerful, but you cannot change the past, and you cannot bend the future to suit your whims."
"Lucy," he said, reaching out for her.
"No, no."
She pushed him away, rejected his offer of comfort.
"You don't understand. You can't possibly. You're all so happy, so perfect."
"We are not."
"You are. You don't even know that you are, and you can't conceive that the rest of us are not, that we might struggle and try to be good and still not receive what we wish for."
Through it all, he watched her. Just watched her and let her stand by herself, hugging her arms to her body, looking small and pale and heartbreakingly alone. And then he asked her, "Do you love me?" She closed her eyes.
"Don't ask me that."
"Do you?" He saw her jaw tighten, saw the way her shoulders tensed and rose, and he knew she was trying to shake her head. Gregory walked towards her, slowly, respectfully. She was hurting. She was hurting so much that it spread through the air, wrapped around him, around his heart. He ached for her. It was a physical thing, terrible and sharp, and for the first time he was beginning to doubt his own ability to make it go away. "Do you love me?" he asked.
"Gregory,
do you love me?"
"I can't."
He placed his hands on her shoulders. She flinched, but she did not move away. He touched her chin, nudged her face until he could lose himself in the blue of her eyes. "Do you love me?"
"Yes,"
she sobbed, collapsing into his arms.
"But I can't. Don't you understand? I shouldn't. I have to make it stop."
For a moment, Gregory could not move. Her admission should have come as a relief, and in a way it did, but more than that, he felt his blood begin to race. He believed in love. Wasn't that the one thing that had been a constant in his life? He believed in love. He believed in its power, in its fundamental goodness, its rightness. He revered it for its strength, respected it for its rarity. And he knew right then, right there, as she cried in his arms, that he would dare anything for it. For love. "Lucy," he whispered, an idea beginning to form in his mind. It was mad, bad, and thoroughly inadvisable, but he could not escape the one thought that was rushing through his brain. She had not consummated her marriage. They still had a chance. "Lucy," she pulled away.
"I must return. They will be missing me."
But he captured her hand. "Don't go back." Her eyes grew huge.
"What do you mean?"
"Come with me. Come with me now." He felt giddy, dangerous, and just a little bit mad. "You are not his wife yet. You can have it annulled."
"Oh, no."
She shook her head, tucking her arm away from him.
"No, Gregory."
"Yes, yes." And the more he thought about it, the more it made sense. They hadn't much time. After this evening, it would be impossible for her to say that she was untouched. Gregory's own actions had made sure of that. If they had any chance of being together, it had to be now. He couldn't kidnap her. There was no way he could remove her from the house without raising an alarm. But he could buy them a bit of time, enough so that he could sort out what to do. He pulled her closer.
"No,"
she said, her voice growing louder. She started really yanking on her arm now, and he could see the panic growing in her eyes. "Lucy, yes," he said.
"I will scream,"
she said. "No one will hear you." She stared at him in shock, and even he could not believe what he was saying.
"Are you threatening me?" she asked.
He shook his head. "No, I'm saving you." And then, before he had the opportunity to reconsider his actions, he grabbed her around the middle and threw her over his shoulder and ran from the room. Chapter 24, in which our hero leaves our heroine in an awkward position.
"You are tying me to a water closet."
"Sorry," he said, tying two scarves into such expert knots that she almost worried that he had done this before. "I couldn't very well leave you in your room. That's the first place anyone will look." He tightened the knots, then tested them for strength. "It was the first place I looked."
"But a water closet.
On the third floor, he added helpfully. It will take hours before anyone finds you here.
Lucy clenched her jaw, desperately trying to contain the fury that was rising within her. He had lashed her hands together behind her back. Good Lord, she had not known it was possible to be so angry with another person. It wasn't just an emotional reaction. Her entire body had erupted with it. She felt hot and prickly, and even though she knew it would do no good, she jerked her arms against the piping of the water closet, grinding her teeth and letting out a frustrated grunt when it did nothing but produce a dull clang.
"Please, don't struggle," he said, dropping a kiss on the top of her head. "It is only going to leave you tired and sore."
He looked up, examining the structure of the water closet.
"Or you'll break the pipe, and surely that cannot be a hygienic prospect."
"Gregory, you have to let me go."
He crouched so that his face was on level with hers.
"I cannot," he said. "Not while there is still a chance for us to be together." "Please," she pleaded. "This is madness. You must return me. I'll be ruined."
"I will marry you," he said.
"I'm already married."
"Not quite," he said with a wolfish smile.
"I said my vows."
"But you did not consummate them. You can still get an annulment."
"That is not the point," she cried out, struggling fruitlessly as he stood and walked to the door. "You don't understand the situation, and you are selfishly putting your own needs and happiness above those of others."
At that he stopped. His hand was on the doorknob, but he stopped, and when he turned around, the look in his eyes nearly broke her heart. "You're happy?" he asked, softly and with such love that she wanted to cry.
"No," she whispered, "but
I've never seen a bride who looked so sad." She closed her eyes, deflated. It was an echo of what Hermione had said, and she knew it was true. And even then, as she looked up at him, her shoulders aching, she could not escape the beatings of her own heart. She loved him. She would always love him. And she hated him, too, for making her want what she could not have. She hated him for loving her so much that he would risk everything to be together. And most of all, she hated him for turning her into the instrument that would destroy her family. Until she'd met Gregory, Hermione and Richard were the only two people in the world for whom she truly cared. And now they would be ruined, brought far lower and into greater unhappiness than Lucy could ever imagine with Hazelby. Gregory thought that it would take hours for someone to find her here, but she knew better. No one would locate her for days. She could not remember the last time anyone had wandered up here. She was in the nanny's washroom, but Finsworth House had not had a nanny in residence for years. When her disappearance was noticed, first they would check her room. Then they'd try a few sensible alternatives. The library, the sitting room, a washroom that had not been in disuse for half a decade. And then, when she was not found, it would be assumed that she'd run off. And after what had happened at the church, no one would think she'd left on her own. She would be ruined, and so would everyone else. "It is not a question of my own happiness," she finally said, her voice quiet, almost broken. "Gregory, I beg of you, please, don't do this. This is not just about me. My family, we will be ruined, all of us." He walked to her side and sat. And then he said, simply, "Tell me." She did. He would not give in otherwise. Of that she was certain. She told him everything, about her father and the written proof of his treason. She told him about the blackmail. She told him how she was the final payment and the only thing that would keep her brother from being stripped of his title. Lucy stared straight ahead throughout the telling, and for that Gregory was grateful, because what she said, it shook him to his very core. All day Gregory had been trying to imagine what terrible secret could possibly induce her to marry Hazelby. He'd run twice through London, first to the church and then here to Finsworth House. He had had plenty of time to think, to wonder. But never, not once, had his imagination led him to this.
"So you see," she said, "it is nothing so common as an illegitimate child, nothing so racy as an extramarital affair. My father, an earl of the realm, committed treason.
treason.
And then she laughed. Laughed, the way people did, when what they really wanted was to cry.
It's an ugly thing, she finished, her voice low and resigned. There is no escaping it.
She turned to him for a response, but he had none. Treason. Good God, he could not think of anything worse. There were many ways, many, many ways, one could get oneself thrown out of society, but nothing was as unforgivable as treason. There wasn't a man, woman, or child in Britain who had not lost someone to Napoleon. The wounds were still too fresh, and even if they weren't, it was treason. A gentleman did not forsake his country. It was ingrained in the soul of every man of Britain. If the truth about Lucy's father were known, the earldom of Fensworth would be dissolved. Lucy's brother would be left destitute. He and Hermione would almost certainly have to emigrate. And Lucy would... Well, Lucy would probably survive the scandal, especially if her surname was changed to Bridgerton. But she would never forgive herself. Of that, Gregory was certain. And finally, he understood. He looked at her. She was pale and drawn, and her hands were clenched tightly in her lap. "My family has been good and true," she said, her voice shaking with emotion. "The Abernathys have been loyal to the crown since the first earl was invested in the 15th century, and my father has shamed us all. I cannot allow it to be revealed. I cannot." She swallowed awkwardly, and then sadly said, "You should see your face. Even you don't want me now."
"No," he said, almost blurting out the word. "No, that's not true. That can never be true."
He took her hands, held them in his own, savoring the shape of them, the arch of her fingers, and the delicate heat of her skin. "I am sorry," he said. "It should not have taken me so long to collect myself. I had not imagined treason." She shook her head.
"How could you?"
"But it does not change how I feel." He took her face in his hands, aching to kiss her, but knowing he could not. "Not yet. What your father did, it is reprehensible. It is..." He swore under his breath. "I'll be honest with you. It leaves me sick. But you, Lucy, you are innocent. You did nothing wrong, and you should not have to pay for his sins."
"Neither should my brother," she said quietly. "But if I do not complete my marriage to Hazelby, Richard would..."
"Shh!" Gregory pressed a finger to her lips. "Listen to me. I love you." Her eyes filled with tears. "I love you," he said again. "There is nothing in this world or the next that could ever make me stop loving you."
"You felt that way about Hermione," she whispered.
"No," he said, almost smiling at how silly it all seemed now. "I've been waiting so long to fall in love that I wanted the love more than the woman. I never loved Hermione, just the idea of her. But with you, it's different, Lucy. It's deeper, it's... He struggled for words, but there were none. Words did not exist to explain what he felt for her. "It's me," he finally said, appalled at the inelegance of it. "Without you, I am Gregory," she whispered.
"You don't have to.
I am nothing," he cut in, because he wasn't going to allow her to tell him that he didn't have to explain. "Without you, I am nothing." She smiled. It was a sad smile, but it was true, and it felt as if he'd been waiting for years for that smile.
"That's not true," she said. "You know that it's not."
He shook his head. "An exaggeration, perhaps, but that is all. You make me better, Lucy. You make me wish and hope and aspire. You make me want to do things." Tears began to trickle down her cheeks. With the pads of his thumbs, he brushed them away. "You are the finest person I know," he said. "The most honorable human being I've ever met. You make me laugh, and you make me think, and I..." He took a deep breath.
"I love you."
And again. "I love you." And again.
I love you. He shook his head helplessly. I don't know how else to say it. She turned away then, twisting her head so that his hands slid from her face to her shoulders, and finally away from her body completely. Gregory could not see her face, but he could hear her, the quiet, broken sound of her breathing, the soft whimper in her voice. I love you, she finally answered, still not looking at him. You know that I do. I will not demean us both by lying about it. And if it were only me, I would do anything, anything for that love. I would risk poverty, ruin. I would move to America. I would move to darkest Africa, if that were the only way to be with you. She let out a long, shaky breath. I cannot be so selfish as to bring down the two people who have loved me so well and for so long. Lucy. He had no idea what he wanted to tell her, just that he didn't want her to finish. He knew he did not want to hear what she had to say. But she cut him off with, Don't, Gregory, please. I'm sorry. I cannot do it. And if you love me, as you say you do, you will bring me back now, before Lord Davenport realizes I've gone missing. Gregory squeezed his fingers into fists, then flexed them wide and straight. He knew what he should do. He should release her, let her run downstairs to the party. He should sneak back out the servant's door and vow never to approach her again. She had promised to love, honor, and obey another man. She was supposed to forsake all others. Surely he fell under that aegis. And yet, he couldn't give up. Not yet. 1 hour, he said, moving into a crouching position beside her. Just give me 1 hour. She turned, her eyes doubtful and astonished, and maybe, maybe, just a little bit hopeful as well. 1 hour, she echoed. What do you think you can... I don't know, he said honestly. But I will promise you this. If I cannot find a way to free you from this blackmail in 1 hour, I will return for you, and I will release you. To return to Hazelby, she whispered, and she sounded... Did she sound disappointed? Even a little. Yes, he said, because in truth it was the only thing he could say. Much as he wished to throw caution to the wind, he knew that he could not steal her away. She would be respectable, as he would marry her as soon as Hazelby agreed to the annulment. But she would never be happy, and he knew that he could not live with himself. You will not be ruined if you go missing for 1 hour, he said to her. You can simply tell people you were overset. You wish to take a nap. I'm sure that Hermione will corroborate your story if you ask her to. Lucy nodded. Will you release my bindings? He gave his head a tiny shake and stood. I would trust you with my life, Lucy, but not with your own. You're far too honorable for your own good. Gregory! He shrugged as he walked to the door. Your conscience will get the better of you. You know that it will. What if I promise... Sorry. One corner of his mouth stretched into a not quite apologetic expression. I won't believe you. He took one last look at her before he left, and he had to smile, which seemed ludicrous given that he had 1 hour to neutralize the blackmail threat against Lucy's family and extract her from her marriage, during her wedding reception. By comparison, moving heaven and earth seemed a far better prospect. And when he turned to Lucy and saw her sitting there on the floor, she looked like herself again. Gregory, she said, you cannot leave me here. What if someone finds you and removes you from the house? Who will know I am here? And what if... And then... What if... He smiled, enjoying her officiousness too much to actually listen to her words. She was definitely herself again. When this is all over, he said, I shall bring you a sandwich. That stopped her short. A sandwich? A sandwich? He twisted the doorknob, but didn't yet pull. You want a sandwich, don't you? You always want a sandwich.
You've gone mad, she said.
He couldn't believe she'd only just come to that conclusion. Don't yell, he warned.
You know I can't, she muttered.